Happy Friday, everybody.
Good morning.
This is Friday, October 23rd, 2020, and this is episode 109 of Transmission.
Ooh. All right.
This week is 110. That's somehow significant because it's even.
There we go.
Yeah.
Okay.
So just to introduce ourselves, I'm Mark Van Steenwijk. I'm the director for the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing. And good morning to Gus and Ron and whoever else is out there.
Hey, Susan. People chiming in.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And yeah, so today is our favorite day, Fascism Friday.
Fascism Friday.
And so
if Trump gets elected, reelected, every day will be Fascism Friday.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, good morning, Kathleen, Ellen. Good morning. Gang's all here. Yeah, so we thought that every once in a while we've done an episode where we sort of hone in on a definition of a term, a word that we use a lot. Because, you know, words get used in all kinds of different ways, and mostly that's confusing.
That's right.
And so, so it occurred to me that it would be good to talk about, especially on Fascism Friday, this word revolution, because we use this a fair amount.
And a lot of people use it.
A lot of people
use it in confusing ways. So we want to talk about what we mean by it.
Yeah, and I think especially. Especially with all of the, you know, Antifa stuff, I think, you know, we now have the great vision of the black clad young men throwing fiery things, doing evil deeds, and yeah. So we want to give a little broader view, I think.
Well, and even just even in, within the realm of political discourse in positive ways, you know, I get emails every once in a while from Our Revolution, which is like kind of the Bernie-crat kind of wing. And they're not really necessarily fomenting revolution. That's kind of more of a metaphor. People talk about Elon Musk revolutionizing the car industry. Like, so we just talk about revolution in all kinds of metaphoric and not so metaphoric ways. So it's,
yeah,
it's kind of important.
So, all right. So why don't you start? Do you want to start?
Yeah.
I can start.
Well, for me at the very base level, I like to, you know, reform and revolution are the two words that people usually hear kind of pitted against each other. To me, reform is some sort of, let's make this system better, serve people better. And so we're not going to fundamentally challenge the base or core of the system. We're going to change how it impacts people, who benefits, who doesn't benefit. Revolution is saying like this whole system fundamentally needs to change. So if you can use it as a metaphor, like it works if you want to say Apple revolutionized the entertainment industry because that the iPad actually fundamentally changed it. So if you're going to use it in that sort of way of talking about it, like in a more metaphoric, non-political way, it means fundamental change. And when we're talking about politics, it gets really murky because almost every revolutionary recognizes that reform is part of the soup. The question is usually when people who, I think it gets foggy, is when you have people who are really reformists saying we need to revolutionize this system, but they, it's kind of like a sneaky way of saying super reform it. So that's where it gets confusing.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, I mean, I really come at this from the spiritual teaching point of view. And you know, revolution, of course, is connected to the word revolt, which is something that we use in a few different ways, like revolt, like as in revolting. like something is, you know, makes us nauseous. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite little spiritual teaching ditties is that, and this comes out of the Buddhist tradition, is that revulsion is the foot of meditation. And I really like that. And what that means is that until you are really sick of your ego process and kind of the way things are about yourself, you're not really going to engage the spiritual life, because the spiritual life is fundamentally about kind of killing the ego. That's the Buddhist language, and entering into what again is this fundamentally different relationship with reality. Right, so it's not about reforming the ego. You know, it's not about just having a kinder, gentler ego or a slightly nicer ego. It really is about getting rid of that particular way of relating to yourself and to others and to reality, and having a totally different way of doing that. But you're going to hold on to that ego process until you're revolted by it. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's the basic definition, in a sense, of this term revolution. That, you know, it's like, you know, like Gus is on here and has been on the show a couple times and, you know, works with those living outdoors. And it's like, until you're fundamentally sick of the reality that in every American city, you can go to a park now and there are people living outdoors and, you know, clearly suffering. And it's like, until you're totally sick of that and you say, no, you know, everybody should have a safe, nice place to live indoors. You're not going to do anything about it, right? You're just going to kind of tinker around the edges and say, oh, well, you know, let's build another temporary shelter, or let's build a stronger tent for them to live in. You know, that's what Minneapolis did a couple years ago, you know, a bigger, nicer tent. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just going to reform the system, and you're not going to say, okay, what is the basic problem here, which is that housing is in this capitalist economy. That's going to always mean that there's going to be a certain set of people that can't afford homes, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets interesting is when you're talking about revolution, you can kind of lean more into sort of the strict materialist side of things, which is, you know, a lot of Marxists I know, they feel like any talk about, you know, inner change is kind of like a little bit of a misdirect. And it sometimes can be. We talk about this too, like how mm-hmm. It could be a form of spiritual bypassing. But there's this way of people want to talk about if we need to change the systems, and that'll automatically change how we relate to the system, mm-hmm. which is true. But then people tends to be a little bit more on the anarchic side of things, say, well, no, we need to fundamentally change how we perceive and engage the system and change our relationships in order to change the system. And that's also true. So there is this tension. You can't, you know, and lots of my favorite thinkers, Paulo Freire talks about how you have to elevate the consciousness of the oppressed as part of the revolutionary task. Gustav Landauer, one of my favorite revolutionaries, said, even if we win the revolution, if we haven't done this inner work of fundamentally changing how we relate to the land, to the spirit, to ourselves, to one another, then we're just going to rebuild the very thing we're revolting against. Yeah. And so this is where there is this tension, and revolution can happen at different scales. Like if a church, for example, like when people in Christian spaces talk about revolutionary, this is what I wish they meant, is that they fundamentally changed the way they did things together. Like, hey, we're going to talk about redistributing our wealth. We're going to talk about who has power in the system. Those are revolutionary type questions. Yep. Reform questions are, how can we make this work better for those people?
Yeah. When I think about a reform question, I think about, let's have another committee meeting to discuss how we're going to give another $10 to people that are having a hard time.
Often what I think happens in public discourse is there's like a rhetoric that sounds more revolutionary or more radical, but the steps people take are more reformist, because underneath it all, like a church says this is true, but we see this with the city council now, is they're worried about the bottom line of money. To me, money is the great obstacle to revolution, and why people get stuck in reform is because they don't want to upset the people with the most power and resources. Mm-hmm. So this is another piece of it, both in the spiritual world and the political world, if you can draw that distinction.
Yeah, and that's why I feel like that tension that you're talking about, of which direction we come at this, is to some degree sort of an artificial thing. I don't think it's an either or, right? No. I think it's a both and, because, whether you're starting exteriorly to say, I'm really committed to changing the system, or whether you're starting interiorly, the two meet, right? I mean, they begin to meet in different ways. And I think about, I think about the impulse to spiritual community. I think about the impulse to, to suddenly, giving away your stuff or whatever, that those two begin to spontaneously arise, right? As you engage this process of, kind of being revolted by things as they are and wanting to change them. And Kathleen has a good question in this regard.
Yeah,
this I guess David's got a pumpkin spice latte recipe for you.
And that's important, because pumpkin spice revolutionized my taste buds. It didn't reform it.
Pumpkin spice did revolutionize a certain level of disgust.
Yeah, because you find it revolting. Kathleen, the more pertinent question or comment, was Jesus being revolutionary and speaking of loving neighbors as yourself? I mean, I would say that has revolutionary implications. And then we saw how he acted it out was revolutionary.
Yeah, I would say that is revolutionary, because what the ego self does is it prioritizes self over everything else. And I think we're seeing that right now in America, right, with our response to the pandemic. I mean, the American response to the pandemic is classically ego-driven, right? It's just all about me, As long as I'm fine, or I'm safe, or I'm getting to live my life the way I want, I don't really care what happens to anybody else. And, these tales I hear of overwhelmed hospitals and people dying, it's like, whatever. I'm fine. My family just went to the lake. We're all okay. you hear this all the time. And so, yes, to love, i.e. to put your heart and desire towards the other rather than towards yourself, is fundamentally revolutionary, because it has to, you have to kind of overthrow this ego process.
The thing that gets tricky when we're talking about, especially something like love, there are very few words, like the more abstract a word is, the more prone we are to self-deception in how we understand and enact that word. So I could go into any church, including the most conservative fundamentalist Baptist church, and say, do you think love is revolutionary? And they're like, yeah, it's so revolutionary. Because what they mean by those things are different. But based on what we're saying, I think one of my favorite, this is a paraphrase of Dorothy Sola, she said that Jesus didn't have to die on the cross. It wasn't necessary. But in our world, where things like the cross exist and oppression exists, love necessarily takes us to the cross. And so that's kind of how I look at it. Like, the way what Jesus meant by love is intrinsically revolutionary, and that's what he did. So anytime Jesus engaged in the social system, including the religious system, out of love, he fundamentally undermined the assumptions of that system. And then the more his disciples acted it out, the more disruptive it became, which is why Christianity had to get co-opted fairly early on, or it could have undermined the whole empire, I think. But some more comments. Going back to Ellen. So you're talking about a revolution? So, so reform is dyeing your hair, revolution is chopping it off. Revolution is replacing your hair with tattoos of hair. When it comes to hair care, I'm not sure what the revolutionary thing is.
Yeah, revolution might be not spending millions of dollars taking care of your hair. Maybe that's revolution.
I think Donald Trump needs a hair revolution. Susan writes, centrists who try not to rock the boat and make change slowly don't acknowledge that in our political system, the 4 or 8 year election cycle is very disruptive to effective slow change. I think that's true. The Republicans have capitalized on the Supreme Court nominations because it assures long-term control of policy. This is one of the you know, one of the issues with when talking about reform or revolutionary politics, we have short memories. So like one of the things, I think progress is generally a myth. People talk about the myth of progress because when people say progress, which is a generally kind of can be reformist language, it doesn't have to be. But when they say progress, they often assume it's inevitable, which isn't the case. And that as long as we keep moving in the right direction, it's always good enough. As long as we're just keep moving things in the right direction, that's enough. Revolutionaries tend to see this as like, no, because it's too dynamic of a system. These slow changes don't accrue as much as you think. In fact, we get so complacent and used to the system that we don't even realize that we're moving the opposite direction sometimes. And then we will point, revolutionaries will point to big things like climate change or other looming crises as a need for a fundamentally different way of doing things. And so this is usually where the argument goes. And it comes up a lot in election cycles because some people think engaging in electoral politics at all is not enough. And it becomes a big debate over how you vote and who you vote for this time of year.
Yeah, and I, you know, when you talk about something like progress, and when we're talking about these issues of reform or revolution, you know, I feel like we also have to be very clear about whether or not we're talking about process or content.
That's right.
So if all you're talking, when you talk about progress, if you're talking about materialism, you know, well, obviously there is progress. I mean, here we are doing this broadcast live on this thing called the internet using these computers, you know, and you all are listening. I mean, you know, right. I mean, that was not possible in the 11th century, right? So there has been material progress. But if we look at the process by which human beings are engaging themselves and others, there basically has been no progress, which is why you can read an ancient spiritual text and go, oh, that sounds really familiar. You know, if there'd been a lot of progress, you would read some psychology texts from the 11th century and you'd go, wow, people were really screwed up back then, but, you know, we've come a long way. But that's not what happens. You read that and you go, oh, yeah, that sounds exactly like we are right now. So from the point of view of human development and the process of humanity engaging each other, there has been zero progress in the last 6,000 years.
Just to add a little bit of extra seasoning to that, too, that I think what Dan's talking about, how if we look back and with an honest assessment, we might see ourselves as fundamentally the same. But this is why I think there's a vested interest in people with power of making the past always seem as horrible as possible. And what that does is like, and I'm not going to say the past is rosy, but I'm also going to say the present isn't either. But if you can make the past seem really freaking horrible, then you can step in as a leader and say, look, we have it so much better than we did then. Because back in the Middle Ages, everyone was murdering each other 24/7. Or like we think of the Wild West as this lawless and violent time when statistically we find that at times it wasn't any more violent than now. It depends on what you're talking about, where it wasn't widespread. Like we do this thing where we twist the past in order to make what we're doing now seem always better. Right. And that's, I think, a trick that people play sometimes. Not that I don't care about medicine and stuff, but that's the first kind of progress that Dan was talking about. We can have a very egalitarian society and technologically advanced medicine at the same time, I think, if we try hard enough. Gus writes, there's also the radical flank effect. MLK's nonviolent change becomes slightly more palatable because there's the threat of those not committed to nonviolence, like Malcolm X, the Deacons, Black Panther Party, etc. Yeah, and we've talked about this before.
I like that.
And it's true. And this is very uncomfortable, especially for those of us whose deep commitment to spiritual practices and the way of compassion makes us averse to killing people. And so we want to make it seem like Martin Luther King and every other nonviolent person by themselves did all this without any fear of a violent upheaval, which isn't true. You have to be honest about that. Bo writes, back in the day, I used to study revolution as an historic topic. One of the four criteria of a revolution was that it had to include violence or implied violence. I mean, yeah, depending on how we look at it. Yeah. Anything that doesn't is really a form of rebellion or reform. That's why we only have the four big revolutions in history, which are the English, American, French, and Russian. I think there's a case to be made there. I feel like there can get into semantics, but I generally agree that the idea of a fully nonviolent revolution and a systemic level really hasn't quite happened, because even the ones we think of as nonviolent, there was that threat of violence that you're talking about, which is uncomfortable.
Yeah, and see, I'm not sure I really completely agree with that. I mean, I really think that if you look at the, you know, the major moments of spiritual teaching and transformation, I think that those have been very revolutionary, and those have certainly been nonviolent by the folks engaging in the new spirituality. Usually the violence there comes from the system towards the people, right? And they're, you know, what you were talking about with Jesus was a great example. I mean,
there was violence, but it wasn't coming.
Yeah, there was violence, but it was coming from the system. So yeah, I mean, you know, human violence is the other thing. I think that and we've certainly talked about this before. You know, when we say something like, oh, you know, the revolutions are violent, but the rest of the time is not, right? I mean, that's complete nonsense. And I think that to me, if we're honest about human beings and about human systems and how we function and how the ego functions, human systems and society are violent all the time. There's constant violence. The moment of revolution is no more or less violent than the present moment. It's just that the violence in the present moment is structured such that we perceive it as being fine and normal. And, you know, I mean, it's like, how can you say that a country that's spending $800 billion a year on weapons and has military bases all around the country is not being violent every single day? I mean, or if you're a person of color, an indigenous person, or a woman, I mean, there's constant violence going on. So I think that's the other thing, is that, you know, history tellers or society picks those moments when those in power were at most threat and say, oh, that's this big, bad, violent time. The rest of the time was being really nice and peaceful. It's like, that's not true at all.
No, systemic establishment violence is often always hidden because it's a little bit more persistent and baked in. Yeah. And so we often downplay that. So that's why, again, we talk about this fairly often. But when someone says, oh my God, America's getting polarized, I'm like, it was polarized before, but it was sustained polarization that didn't affect the dominant culture as much. But if you're a black person, you haven't ever experienced non-polarized America. So I think revolution comes the same way. It might be helpful. And I guess in my mind, one way that I could slice and dice this, if you're talking about revolution with a capital R and you're talking about it when it comes to an entire society, then maybe, yes, it's fair to say when we're talking about revolutionary wars that fundamentally changed a society, those aren't very common. If we're talking about revolutionary, the way I would maybe say something is anarchic or anarchistic, like I don't think we've ever really had much by way of pure anarchism, but you can point to things as being anarchistic, something that undermines top-down authority. And the same for any time we engage in a system in a fundamentally different way, it's revolutionary, maybe with a lowercase r if we want to quibble over language. But I think the thing is, if you get enough of those little r things together in a system, it's just fundamentally revolutionary in a deep way, and it accumulates maybe to uppercase revolution. I don't know. One of my favorite, David Graeber, who passed away recently, wrote things like Bullshit Jobs, Debt. He wrote a little tiny pamphlet called Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology. And I liked what he says. He said, anytime any group of people fundamentally changes their ways of relating with one another and it upends established social hierarchies, that is a revolution. And I think whenever I say I want churches in particular to be revolutionary, that's what I mean. We need to fundamentally change how we relate to one another. Ceres is saying maybe we can see movements as an ecology and that there are various parts that connect to it. Maybe that can help reduce the need of falling into false binaries that we make between changing systems or ourselves. And I agree. I don't know. There's like a link I'll leave up for a moment. The A, Y, and I, I'm not sure what that means, Institute, movement ecology.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great way of thinking about it. And I actually wish that people within movements would see that more rather, you know, and this is a great example of the ego process, right? Is that rather than seeing that movement space as an ecology that we all just plug into in different ways, usually people then sort of fight over, you know, who's right, who's more radical than the other group, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, that just replicates this process of the system and undermines the strength of movements.
Well, and this ecological piece of noticing how our engagement in system not only changes the system fundamentally, but also is educating us in that, forming us deeply. That's work that doesn't get done enough. And I mean, that's kind of why we do this. That's what both Micah and CPI spend a lot of energy thinking about and engaging. Because, I mean, we see this right now when it comes to the struggle for Black lives. A lot of books out there and the way that white people are engaging this tends to fall under white catharsis, where we're trying to figure out like how to feel sufficiently bad in the right ways about whiteness. And then we kind of feel like I have a come to Jesus moment where I feel really fully sufficiently bad about being white. And then I think somehow by magic, it's going to change the way I relate to the Black people that I've run into on the street, because I don't really have maybe a lot in my life. Like that kind of, there's a lot of that. And that's not the same. That's no substitute for a fundamental changing of the way we relate. But at the same time, I've been in enough activist spaces where we're trying to push things. And we do it from a place of trying to use our energy of our lives like it's a battery. And if we spend ourselves enough, we'll affect change. We don't have time to think about how it's affecting me personally and how it shapes me, but we'll deal with that later. Like both of those are flawed, broken ways of dealing with change. Ellen has to say, literally had that conversation, we can't help everyone all the way, last night, Dan. Why do Christians feel like running out of money is the biggest problem? And how is keeping your money, $1 million, creating geographic areas so we can cite policy? Why we don't have to help? Dollar limits so we don't give one person more than $250 a year saying, we have nothing for you. The thing they are afraid they will have to say.
Money in church spaces could be a whole episode. It's just so depressing.
There's a reason, you know, Jesus said the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil.
Yeah. I mean, just as one example, in the Presbyterian system that I'm a part of, we have these things called synods, which are these big geographic church body regions. And I remember having a conversation with some folks in the Synod government about how the Synod was broke, and they had $14 million on their balance sheet. Now, I don't know about you guys, but when I think about being broke, I think about having no money, not $14 million.
So, talk a lot about that. Money ruins all kinds of things. Boer says, should have read A Form of Reform in an earlier comment. Voice to text, bah. I agree. Bah. Ron writes, good point, Mark. Would the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia with Václav Havel be considered an example of a true nonviolent revolution? I don't know enough about it to say for sure. Maybe Dan knows a lot about the Velvet Revolution. But to me, it's like seems like there's still the implicit threat of external violence. I mean, because we're talking about Cold War type stuff. I feel like it's hard to really draw a line between violent and nonviolent. But I generally affirm the nonviolent impulse within systems change as much as possible. So, and I think people get a little bit too, when it comes to the revolutionary left, people get a little bit too machismo for my taste. Like, yeah, we're going to take up arms against the government. Like, no, you're not. To me, any revolution in our world right now, if we're talking about within the United States context, really needs to have a solid basis and nonviolent strategies. But then I'm also like, when things happened here, the uprising in Minneapolis, where things got a little bit burny, I'm also not being going to be like, this is getting too out of hand about it either.
All right. Well, as often the case, we're over time with a bunch of great comments. So we need to
blaze through.
Get through those.
Catherine says, example, evictions are violence, but our main societal narrative doesn't frame it that way. That's very accurate.
That's a great example.
Depriving people access to land, that is what happens to indigenous people still all the time. That's a form of violence. You're right.
Assassinate the one to save millions.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Those asterisks threw me off, Ellen. I love that, Dan. The enclosing of the commons in England was a huge revolution against the people.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah.
Sirius writes, how do we have a revolution that does not lead to unintentionally leaving very vulnerable members behind in the revolution? I mean, our movements are still unwilling to disabled people in our movements.
To include disabled people. Yeah. Yeah. Well, right. And, you know, and this is where, again, I mean, to me, this notion that revolution is limited to this very narrow slice of, people marching in the streets and burning stuff. That to me is actually a definition of revolution that I feel like the system gives us and imposes upon us. I feel like we've seen a lot of that in the last several weeks and months. When I talk to my friends in the disability community, what they say would be revolutionary is if able-bodied people just got it through their heads that you need to have a meeting in a place that was accessible. Right. So I think that, and again, to me, this is the ego escape from this, that revolution can be very, very tiny. And in fact, for most of us, that's the only kind of revolution we'll ever be able to engage in. And we don't take that seriously enough. And so we don't do it. And so then we stay part of the system. And, we just see this all the time. And again, churches are a great place. One little example, I came to my seminary board and I said, you've got this huge investment portfolio. Let's start investing in these microloan programs around the world that are actually helping regular people on the ground instead of the S&P 500. And they said, oh, no, we can't do that. We have a fiduciary responsibility to the seminary. That's not what the seminary is here for. I mean, they literally said that. That is not what the seminary is here for. It's not here to actually be a different Christian witness in the world. It's here to educate pastors. Right. So even that little thing was perceived of as incredibly revolutionary, like only get a 2% return. And this wasn't even giving their money away. they're still going to get a return on their money. But it was only a 2% return instead of a 10% return from these giant multinational corporations. And they were like, no, we can't do that. So, yeah, I think we need to take our view of revolution and make it really small, because that's actually much more personally threatening to us and to the systems we engage in.
I think if we kind of, if we keep our emphasis on fundamentally changing relationships, I mean, that how we relate. So if we get to the business of noticing where I think we see toxicity or domination, and this is where I put myself in the anarchist category, because the thing I want to emphasize is, where do I notice fundamentally unhealthy relationships, and how do we change those relationships fundamentally? And we need to do that at a small level. And then if we see that there's an opportunity to affect larger change, I think we need to be willing to be courageous to do that. But at the same time, so that's kind of a way of thinking where, like, we can't get so bogged down with what's in front of us that we don't notice larger systems and opportunities to change bigger. But then on the flip side, there's this always this temptation to minimize changing the relationships around us, because we want to put all of our energy into the big enchilada. And this is what you're talking about. Like, we don't have time to fundamentally change a relationship with disabled people. We have to end capitalism. Like, somehow those things are at odds with each other. And I think we can do different kinds of revolution at the same time. If by revolution we mean fundamentally changing relationships. I think it's all Kathleen. Right. Writes, I was taught as a child the American Revolution was great because it freed us from the tyranny of a monarchy. Now I wonder, was it really that much better? Especially because Canada didn't even have to go through that to kind of get to be their own country. We could have been like Canada if we just waited a little bit longer. And we'd have, like, she'd be on her money, the queen, instead of, like, these, you know, these dudes that we see all the time. Ceres writes, white catharsis. That describes a lot of allyship training. Barf.
Barf. Yep. Yeah. Let's have another book group.
Catherine writes, how do we assess the strength of good radical work in a way that doesn't depend on it directly resulting in immediate massive change? And then yelling at each other and blaming the quote-unquote failure of that not happening and the other relatively poor people not being quote-unquote revolutionary enough.
Yeah. Right. Well, and I think it's this this change of relationship that you're talking about, and this evidence of personal transformation and personal process change. The Iona community gets together and they have these little accountability groups, and they just ask, it's just three questions, and you have to get together every year with your little accountability group, and you say, what are you doing with your time? What are you doing with your money? And what are you doing with taking care of yourself? And that's the assessment. And is that moving more towards the revolutionary spiritual life or not? So I think that's a great little rubric.
Ron writes, appreciate you guys. Thanks. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
That's actually really encouraging to hear.
Yes.
Ellen writes, the people in my committee called microloans, quote, keeping the poor in debt and becoming a moneylender. aren't microloans usually not usurious? Like, they're low interest, right?
Right.
I mean, yeah. I don't think, yeah, we can
All
talk
right.
about debt.
Let's
debt
move is, on.
Good stuff, guys. Very enlightening for me. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks, Ed. Appreciate it.
Final comment from Scott. We need consistency from the macro to the micro. But the most dominant and vicious powers do have to have a certain priority and focus, because solidarity with the least of these is paramount over our personal struggles. There's a lot to unpack there. I generally agree in the sense that everyone always has to figure out how to prioritize our energy. That's part of the challenge. And among radical types, in particular, it's easy to get fatigued and overwhelmed because there's so much crap. We do have to prioritize. The thing that I don't like about that happens is there's a dishonesty that creeps in, and a way of prioritizing that brackets things off. So what I mean is this. I might think that, for example, racism in our society came about because of the fusion of religious supremacy and capitalism kind of created this mix where we had to create whiteness. But I would never say, oh, we need to deal with capitalism first before we deal with racism, which is what happens a lot in conversations. Like, it's possible to not have to prioritize things in such a way that we delegitimize the struggle of certain people, which I think is the danger that happens. But you're right, like, we do kind of have to prioritize with our own energy and grapple with that and balance our personal struggles and not overemphasize our personal struggles to the detriment of how we treat other people.
All right. Well, you can tell there's way a lot over. To say here. We're way over. Thanks for hanging in with us. We appreciate all of you. Appreciate the great comments. And we will not be here on Monday. I may be stuck in the snow somewhere. More about that on Tuesday. We'll see you then.
Yep. See you Tuesday, everybody. Thank you.